This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Ole Demogod, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you so much, Jerm, and it's a real pleasure. I've been actually really looking forward to this because this is the first interview I do in South Africa. I've been interviewed more than 1,300 times all over, but never South Africa. So I'm excited.
The media is so interesting; it makes South Africa look like a complete hellhole.
I don't look at me in media.
No, I don't. That's a good start.
No, I don't, because it's sort of like I come from a journalistic background. I know that it was hijacked. I mean, I used to be really proud of calling myself a journalist, and then now this word, this title doesn't exist anymore, if you ask me. Real journalists are people like us who are sort of taking the power back and doing the hard work. So mainstream media, unfortunately, over the years also has been hijacked through the ownership of these big multinational corporations. So the news as well has been hijacked. It's very sad. For me, I mean, I don't use, if you look at my CV, it says former journalist, because I've just let that go. That word doesn't exist anymore, because real news, we're not being fed real news. So I'm not looking at mainstream media at all. One of the reasons is because at the moment we live in Bali here since 4 years. And I mean, people are calling from time to time saying, "How are you?" I said, "I'm fine. How are you?" "Yeah, but how are you? There's been an earthquake." I'm like, "What? Where?" "Right where you live." "What? Yes, yes. Just a few hours ago." "How do you know?" "I saw it on the mainstream news." I said, "I've been here all the time. No earthquakes as far as I know, but I'll let you know if there is." When we lived in Spain, the same there, people were calling me, "How are you?" "I'm good. How are you?" "Yeah, but there's this massive fire." "Where?" "Right where you are." I'm like, "What?" This is the thing. You always have this chaos, the generation of chaos, and very often it's generated at a place far from you, on the outskirts of your world, so that you won't be able to, the chances of you having someone there to call and say, "Is this really happening?" is not that big, you know. So this is where we're being told all of this horror happens, all of these things happen. And also, I was in Iran during the war, when Iran was the worst of the worst. I mean, it was a hellhole for the poor people who was there. And in the news said, "Never ever have the people been better off than now. Only good news, but the situation was horrible, horrible." And so I heard this interview with a real journalist many years ago, and he said the news is something that breaks away from what actually is. Otherwise, it wouldn't be news. If everybody is happy and then something horrible happens, it would be the horrible thing that the news is focused on. It said, "Everybody's happy, but then unfortunately this happened. Well, we're not even going to look at it." So actually, it's almost a sign of wealth and health and stuff like that when the media says it's horrible, because then normally you go there and it's a beautiful place. So I don't even look at the news. And at the same time, of course, you have to be aware of stuff also.
But then how do you discern between fact and fiction?
Welcome to my world. Not easy. I mean, how do you know that something has happened? How do you know? How do you know that there's a war in the Ukraine? How do you know that the war in Gaza is happening? How do you know that thousands of people are suffering from bioweapons in the form of vaccines? How do you know that they're not? How do we know? We know it through screens. And information that is being transferred to us digitally to screens where we have absolutely no control who's the one feeding us with it, but it's saying, "This is the truth, this is the truth, this is live from here, this is live from there." But so many times what I specialized on as a one-man band for many years was when something happened, I went to the location. When the Bataclan massacre happened, boom, within a few days I was there. When the Brussels airport attack happened, I was there. Boom, just right after. When the mass shooting in Copenhagen happened, I went there on my own. I tell you, very scary, because these operations, if they were not the deeds of so-called terrorists, they were inside jobs, which is the thing that unfortunately was the result of my research every single time on location. So every time I went there, I found the exact opposite of what was being told. So the only way to control if something actually happened is, were you there? And even if you are there, it is very easy sometimes to stage an event right in front of you so that you think that you're a witness to something real, and sometimes it's not. So when you look at these, how these psychological operations are carried out, and also how black ops are carried out and all, deception is key. Deception is key. So how do I know that anything is true? I don't. I always have to really like, whoa, wait a second. Before I jump to any kind of conclusion, I have to see who benefits from me believing whatever it is they're telling me. It normally is like, boom, something happens. And if it's something that is fear-based, I take a step back and I say, whoa, wait a second. Could this be built on problem reaction solution, this very ancient old template, power template from the people in control behind the scenes pulling the strings? Boom, scare the living bejesus out of us with a bomb, a mass shooting, an alleged virus. They love the viruses, or a financial crash, or something horrendous that just happened. Boom. If the natural reaction would be, oh my God, I take a step back, because then it's very possible that this is exactly where they want me, where I react instead of taking a deep breath, go for a little walk, hug a cat, hug a cop, whatever works, and then come down and calmly look at the situation. And then very often nowadays, they're making it very easy for us, because the concentration span for most of us is very short. So they have to, before you change channel or before you start looking at shorts on YouTube or whatever, they have to hammer in the message right away to make sure that they get to you if it's one of these operations. So it's problem, boom, reaction, oh my God, and wait for it, boom, there's the solution. We need more cameras, we need more surveillance, we need to blame the immigrants, we need to this, we need to do that, we need to... And so I don't know what is really true many times, and I take it very, very easy to jump to conclusions. So you are in South Africa. What I know to be true, meaning I have no clue, is that a lot of people out in the countryside, ranch owners and stuff like that, have been slaughtered and murdered, and black leaders are saying, you know, kill them, eat them for breakfast. And is it true? I have no idea. But that is what I'm being fed through screens that are controlled by other people. There was a massive scandal a few years ago. I think it was called Britannica or something like that, where this company had been hired for the elections. I think it was for the US elections. And they had specialized in people that coordinated the different social platforms, so that they handpicked and handmade the feed to every single individual with the help of massive databases, I think AI as well, so that...
Cambridge. You're talking about... that's Cambridge Analytica.
That's the one. Sorry. That's the one. Where they handmade, especially the information flow to you, which would be different from the information flow to me, which would be different from the information flow to my sweetheart. And so on.
Well, definitely inflammation.
Inflammation. That is a better word. Inflammation. So the thing is, when people say, oh my God, Twitter, it's so horrible, they're so aggressive, they're so rude, I've never seen anything like that. Oh, Facebook, it's only about this and that. My Facebook looks different. Do you know? And so what is true, what is not? So I doubt everything. I really do. I doubt everything. And I know that I don't know, and I'm unlearning on a daily basis from things that I thought I knew, because what I'm finding out more and more is that we're in an inverted reality, where what being fed so often is the complete opposite of what I believe is true. And I think this is, I call it 4D reality between 3D reality and 5D reality, where many of, I think many of your listeners are also in what I call 4D reality, where we are in a place where it looks like 3D reality, but it's just like, what the hell is going on? It's so upside down, so twisted, so bizarre. It's almost like black is white is black, up is down. Did you know like that? Oh, this is so good for you. Take it, jab yourself, do whatever. And it's killing you. This is so bad for you, like individuals like myself. Truth is so bad for you. Stay away. Cinnamon, my God, we need to ban it. All of these things. When they try to ban something, I would suggest could be an idea to look into it. When they try to say this is good for you, I would strongly advise check it out before you do anything, especially put it inside your jaw, your body, because it is upside down. Like the head of the CIA, Dick Casey, in the 90s, he said the day when the American population, everything they believe in is based on lies, we have succeeded. And I would strongly suggest we're very close to be at that point.
Why, though? What is the end game?
You tell me. I mean, I can only say I try to simplify. This is a simple mind, and I try to make it easy for me because it's very easy to get lost in information, which is also part of the design. Sometimes we're overwhelmed with information. So, I mean, I've been down this rabbit hole for some 40 odd years. I've been diving deeper than anyone else that I know, almost. I've been in areas that very few other people that I know have been. And so what I know is that I don't know. That's it. But also, I completely lost the thread. You were asking about what?
No, I was saying why. Why is everything inverted?
Okay, so if you look at, you can look and you can say, who's behind that? Oh, it's the Jesuits. Oh, it's the Bilderberg Group. Oh, it's the Trilateral Commission.
Well, the Jews.
It's the Jews. Yeah, but they are very central in this. Not the Jews, the one that are hiding behind them. They're hiding behind this as a cover and using them as a human shield. The ones, the real bad boys are behind them, like with dual citizenship in the Zionist area. But these are only also humans. And when you look at who's, what we're really up against, I think it's like a corrupted mindset that is driven by the force coming from below, where the big boss is kind of reddish skin with horns and eats with a fork. It's pure evil we're up against, pure evil. And the people with a corrupt mindset enough, or born psychopaths, are very open to be taken over by this mindset. And then they do all of these horrendous acts of horror. But it's the mindset, it's the power. And so what are we up against? I would say pure evil. That I just make it easy. Because when you see whoever can sort of like start like bombing like children and stuff like that, you know, like defenseless people or doing all kinds of horror, or jab people or give them whatever. And you know, this is causing so much pain and suffering and death. If you can do that, you have to ask yourself, what is driving that person? Pure evil. That is what is labeled pure evil. And in South Africa, you even had one guy that was very deeply involved in the alleged assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister, Eugen de Kock. And his gang name in that business of death was pure evil. And I think, I'm over the years, I've been really trying to understand evil. I've been looking in my bookshelves over the years, it's sort of like New Age and spirituality and then serial killers and mass murder and nothing in between. No 50 Shades of Grey in my world. It's like this or that. And I think I've sometimes thought, am I schizophrenic or what the hell is that? It's a really very drastic like this. But what I think is I've been trying to find out about duality and the polarities. What is going on? What is it that is driving these individuals? What is doing it? And so over the years of me deep diving into these areas, I've started, I wouldn't say surrounding myself, but with former assassins, with black ops, with people that have done horrendous things, but have come to term. Very often they've had a near-death experience, or Jesus have come and said, hello, God, you know, Jimmy, this is not on. You have to completely change your life. And boom, once they start seeing, oh, what the hell have I been doing with my life? There's this boom, and then they come out on the other side, which I find very interesting when you speak to somebody like a former, who you would describe as a monster who is capable of doing whatever of horror, and then suddenly they're on the other side. Then you have the whole spectrum. And so I've been going down, I've been interviewing assassins, I've interviewed the guy that shot the head of Kennedy several times. He's still around. His name is James Files. He was one of multiple shooters that day in Dealey Plaza. I'm a friend of Chip Tatum, who was the former commander of George Bush Sr.'s private hit team, Pegasus. He was part of taking out 14. They did 14 assassinations at least. But like Jimmy Files and other people that I have been pretty close to, they're up to like 1,000 deaths. They've caused the death of 1,000 people. But him and several of the other people have been born into programs for assassins. They were like Jimmy Files. His mother was very poor in Alabama in 1942, and she signed up for this program, more or less like a super soldier type of program, where she got inseminated by an Aryan type looking guy, like a very athletic type individual, got pregnant, and then gave birth to this child that was taken away from her right away and was taken care of by these doctors from Operation Paperclip and this whole thing. And then his whole life, he never went to a normal school. He never went to high school. From day one, he was turned into a killer. He's 81 now. He's not doing so good right now. But I mean, death was his game. And that he was in Dealey Plaza that day. He was not there as a shooter, but he was asked in the last minute, would you mind becoming a backup shooter? It's like he says, for him, it was like taking out the trash. He couldn't care less. You know, so, but at the same time, this man has a standard of morals and honor that is up here. It's on, you know, he was a hitman for the mob, and he was working for the CIA for many years. He was almost tortured to death he was left as dead. They tortured him to death to give up information of people. He did not rat. I mean, whoever can take that, you have to say, my God, that is incredible power of a human being. And then, yes, the name of his business was death. And so in one situation, people are saluted. Oh, look at this American sniper. What a hero. All these medals. He had like 1,600 confirmed kills. What the hell is that? Like a sniper, if you come from a point of a cowardice, can you be more of a coward to lie around and, you know, sneak in on people and blow them away like 1 mile away? And then they're saluted as heroes because they were killing bad guys or terrorists. Who says who's who? Well, they were Afghani. Well, to start with, what were you doing in Afghanistan, a war that was built on 100% lies that had nothing to do with nothing? Well, I was in Iraq too. Well, they just got you there as well because you have been completely duped into doing absolute horror. So who is the bad guy? Who is the good guy? It's very confusing. But I know that I respect a person like Jimmy Files. What they did in Dallas, horrendous, horrendous, horrendous. That assassination, I mean, come on. The worst of the worst to do a thing like that. No honor, no courage, no nothing. Awful, awful. Completely without bodyguards. Everything was pulled back, brought to slaughter. Horrendous. At the same time, you have somebody who's standing up and standing in the truth, admitting to what he was doing from inside a high security prison surrounded by the forces that were, he was working for to carry out these things. Unbelievably brave to do. And then you compare to like politicians and the people that are now completely selling out their countries into this New World Order agenda. No spine, personality of jelly, saying whatever you want to hear, absolute like a big pile of yogurt. Like, and we're supposed to look up to them because they've got bodyguards and some flags in the background and they drive around in a BMW and they have a long title. I don't think so at all.
Do you think The Matrix then was a very good documentary?
I tell you, The Matrix for me is very interesting. The first one, The Matrix, I get goosebumps or spirituals when I say it. The Matrix, I mean...
Spirituals.
That's
I love that.
That's how the native Indians say it. It's your soul is reacting to truth. So, I mean, not the whole first episode, but in there are parts that were being said in the first Matrix, unbelievably powerful, I think. You have the Truman Show. They're telling us, you know, that one of the people involved in the production was a Rothschild. That's interesting also. I think, I can't remember, Peter Rothschild, I think his name was. Westworld is another one that I've been like, whoa. So, I mean, you ask me what is true, what is not. I don't even know what we're living in. To me, this is more and more looking like a virtual reality experience for where my soul, my higher self, is playing this meat suit that walks around and talks to people with the name of Jeremy, who's online somewhere else. Your higher self is somewhere else sitting with a remote, and your meat suit is right now located on a map called South Africa, and we are connected in this virtual reality game. I don't know, but I feel that this is also why I let go of a lot of judgment. I try to see the sin instead of the sinner. I try to detach from emotional. I'm not driven by rage or revenge or anything like that. I'm here to save humanity in the way I see it, transcend this madness and bring this to a whole new level of oneness. That's my goal. But on the way there, to get there, it seems like a lot of this whole thing is built on lies and deception. And so I say transparency, truth is the way out. And absolute no bullshit. So I track down bullshitters and I expose them. So I track down assassins. I track down these operations that are a massive part of the controlling mechanism and expose them for what they are. Because when you let the truth do the work, no criminal can work out in the open. They are always in the hiding, you know, in the shadows, manipulating, doing all of this stuff. Because if we see, if they know that we see them, we neutralize them. So my aim and my website is also light on conspiracies. Aim the light into the belly of the beast. Absolutely no violence. Just aim it and they will destroy from the inside. They cannot work if you aim the light at them. If you say, we see you, you know, boom. And that's how my last name became a verb.
I'm not following. Your last name became a verb.
Okay, so many years ago, I was told by an insider of these false flag operations, absolute mindfuck operations, where the attacked one is actually the attacker. It's an old naval term on how to get people to accept the solution. They have to create a problem for us to say, oh my God, so that we will accept the solution. So the solution is there from day one. So the problem is then created to get the reaction and then the solution. That's why I take it very easy when people say there's a problem over there. Something bad is happening over there. Or is it? You know, because what is the... Anyway, so I've been exposing false flag operations for many years. And I've become very good at decoding and debunking the modus operandi, how they're carrying out all the different ingredients in these type of operations, psychological operations, how they deceive us, the locations, all of these things, how, who's actually carrying it out, how they're doing it. All. And so I've been doing, like I said, I've been interviewed more than 1,300 times, 2 hours at a time. That is a lot of research that I've gone into that to be, you know, invited to shows like yours. So then one day I was in the fall of 2014, I was contacted by somebody who worked in these operations. And he said, I'm afraid of contacting you, but I really like what you're doing. I admire what you're doing and the courage and all of the determination, all of this thing. You're doing great, but you're missing out on the clues. I was like, what do you mean? He said, the hidden clues. I was like, what? He said, the people in these operations are very aware of the law of karma. What you do comes back to you. And they're terrified of this law because they're doing so much horror. So he said, the way they see it is that if they show us, even in subtle ways, what they're up to, and we don't react, then indirectly we consent. And then that makes the bad karma come on our shoulders, not theirs. You see what I'm saying? So he said that what they're doing is that they're hiding clues about upcoming attacks in the forensic evidence. And I said, that is the most stupid thing I've ever heard. And he said, well, that's the way it works. So I didn't believe him to start with. But then in the fall of 2014, I started seeing, oh my God, it seems like he's actually accurate. I started finding these clues that were pointing towards different things. And then in February 2015 was the first time I thought, oh my God, I found all of these things that are pointing with the date and all. And so that was the first time I went out in international media warning for the mass shooting in Copenhagen. And boom, it happened. So I was on these big shows and then it happened, not the other way around. And then right a week later, I was exposing one in Italy. We're talking NATO operations. It's more or less always in NATO countries these things happen. So I exposed that in Italy. Boom, it was stopped. So of these four that I was looking into, I nailed two and the other ones matched the pattern. So I thought, wow, that could very well be four out of four. So maybe this guy was actually telling me the truth. And once I started seeing that that was the case, I go for the clues. When something happens, everybody else says, look at the official narrative, look at that. I collect everything, look, all, pointing in all different directions. I collect all of the pieces. And then I look for the clue. Where is it? If it's one of their operations, there will be a clue. And the clue is very often in one photo hidden among many, many other stuff. Sometimes it's almost like a Dan Brown novel, so it can go like in different steps. But they're pointers, direct pointers to the next. And over the year, I've started becoming very good at this because now I know what to look for. And so I've up to date, I think up to 2-3 months sometimes before they happen, I've connected or exposed or stopped 74 of these alleged mass shootings or alleged terror attacks. Like I said, up to 2 months before they happen sometimes. So that has been on internationally known and labeled Damagarding, hashtag Damagarding or hashtag Damagarding, is to find the hidden clues and be part of stopping exposing upcoming attacks. Because this is the thing. Once we become aware of that this is what they do, then it's a blessing in disguise because then you see what they're going to do and then we can stop it by being on location with cameras, with all of this. So when they come and start setting it up and they are being observed by people with cameras saying, yeah, I don't think so. I mean, you can keep unpacking. We're going to keep filming you. And you're online, by the way. It's live online. So stop. Don't try and mess with us. And then they just have to abort the operation. And many, many times this has happened.
Are you saying that perhaps a way of looking at this would be that, yes, something perhaps happened. Now let's figure out what actually happened. Like, for example, 9/11, right? So we all were alive and we all saw something happening on TV. And if you go to New York, you can see the buildings are not there. But what actually happened, I suppose, then becomes the conversation, right?
I would say that what is the most important thing? Most people focus on how did the buildings come down? Okay, yeah, for sure. That's interesting because either there were two airplanes that came in and then in some amazing way, some magical trick, managed to dustify, they turned into dust. There were no rubble. There should have been like 13 stories high of rubble. Nothing. No furniture, no bodies in the thousands, no fax machines, phones, chairs, tables, cabinets, anything like that. It became dust. So you're telling me that two planes that were made of aluminum, yes, they had engines of titanium, whatever, 5 ton, but otherwise than that, it's a tube of aluminum and empty air. Yeah, but it was the jet fuel. So the jet fuel managed to dustify these two massive buildings. I don't think so. You can just do an experiment. You take jet fuel, fill empty a Coca-Cola can, fill it with jet fuel, light the jet fuel, smash the can up against a concrete wall. Will it dustify? The day it will, I will believe the official narrative. Up until then, this is what you can get from me. Absolute bullshit on steroids. So how did they come down? That's one thing, because when you really start looking into it, I would suggest they were using every single time of weapon technology to bring them down. Controlled demolition was one part of it. So nanothermite, directed energy weapons, you had all kinds of Star Wars technology also. And I would very much like to point out one place where the energy came from, where very few people have, I don't even know anyone else than me, are pointing it out. Brookhaven National Laboratory. That's where they got like a particle accelerator. That's where the energy was coming to bring these things down. Free fall speed, woof, like that. And it wasn't only two towers. It was multiple towers. It was also more than three towers.
Yeah.
It was tower six, tower five, all of that whole thing. Anyway, so you can stand there and for 20 odd years discuss, was it or was it not? Was it or was it not? I would suggest the day when you catch these bad boys, it would be a very good idea to sit down and say, okay, listen, guys, now when we got you by the balls, tell us, how did you do it? Because that energy, that level of energy that can do that, maybe that can be used for something incredibly good for humanity. Until that day, focus on who did it. What did they do? Why did they do it? Are they still around? Because if so, maybe we should be more focused on what they're up to now. But very few people have really looked into who was the ones carrying it out. You have now multiple wars with millions of casualties that are built on that event. And people are still looking at the holes. And I mean, you look at what they've created out of that, like a one massive obelisk New World Order tower. It's even called the New World Tower or something like that. I mean, it is in your face, the level of, it's a super inside job with handpicked, very corrupt elements in the US government, with the Israel strongly involved and Saudi money incredibly involved in that whole thing. It had nothing to do with 19 hijackers, 9 of them still alive, with commercial pilot's license. Go figure that one, even though they officially died. But otherwise, all of that, the official narrative, don't even look at it. The NIST report, I mean, find a better way to fall asleep. It is just absolute, once again, the technical term, bullshit on steroids. That's the most accurate. That's not a true word anywhere. But the what happened to the world that day was like a coup d'etat, a global coup d'etat, step two. You had JFK, massive turn, power turn like that. And then 9/11, massive turn around when it comes to the power. And then COVID, massive, once again, a massive step up that they use these three, I would say like a three-step rocket. Same power structure behind.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I was alluding to, that there's a common thread.
Yeah. You can say that again.
I mean, COVID, I think COVID is probably the biggest event in living memory, in at least for me.
I tell you, COVID, the world only experienced a fraction of what was planned. Very few people are aware of that. And I don't want to polish my halo, but I want to polish my halo for being a super...
No, please
yeah,
do.
Because it was not me as such, but it was. I was sort of the tool being used to stop 95% of what was planned that day. I've been giving testimony to the Corona Investigative Committee, like the International Coalition of Lawyers. Hang on 2 seconds, please. Agung, would you mind putting on the light? Sorry about that. It's just getting dark here.
You're referring to Rainer and Vivian?
Rainer Fulmisch. I'm referring to Rainer Fulmisch. Yeah, Vivian was there also when I did this whole thing. But anyway, what was planned for the world was a level of chaos unheard of. It was like 9/11 times 100. There were 39 coordinated attacks in Western Europe planned to take place on October the 23rd and 24th. You had Event 201 that was on the 18th and 19th October. This is 2019.
October.
This is 2019. It was just a few days before that. They had the whole drill, all of the preparations were done, and then it was meant to go down on October 23 and 24. But through guidance, I mean, I don't know if you believe in angels or not. I've never seen them, but I'm being told that I'm surrounded by them. And if you are, I don't doubt you, but thank you, because I shouldn't be alive, I tell you. Anyway, sometimes I feel that I'm being guided by something, somebody, to find these breadcrumbs. And this one led me, it was just by a so-called coincidence that I stumbled across things that led me straight into seeing, oh my God, what? This was on October the 21st. So when I saw, I was led down this path, finding all of these stuff that was pointing out what they were going to pull off, like within 48 hours, I just felt, my God. I mean, first I almost puked because when I started seeing the magnitude of this whole thing was just incredibly big. And so what I did was I sat down together with my tour organizer, and we contacted, I don't know how many radio stations around the world. I have an incredible network of radio hosts like yourself. People that are right there if needed, you know, brave and honest and fast and efficient, wonderful people. So I called and I did like five minute interviews saying, please be aware, this is as far as I see, this is what could go down. And since I have a track record with all of these confirmed, operations, this whole demigodding thing, people were really listening and they were acting very fast. This was on October the 21st and October the 22nd. So for 12 hours straight, I contacted as many of these radio stations as I could, saying, it's going to go down. If I'm correct, then it's going to go down on October the 23, October 24. These are the locations: London, Manchester, Barcelona, Rotterdam, Paris, and did I say Barcelona? And up in Stockholm. These are the places, bump, 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 bump. There's going to be 39 coordinated attacks where they're going to knock out all of these very, very specific locations to hit Western Europe with a massive bang. I can, if you're interested, I can go through what I believe was what the real plan was. So all of these radio stations went out there, and even like in in Bulgaria and Slovenia, and there were all kinds of people there that heard this, and then they translated and did videos in their own language, because in certain areas of certain countries, they're not that good in English speaking. So they did their own. So it's like, bombi, bombi, damigard, damigard, bombi, bomb, you know, like all of these spreading it. So within 24 hours, it was all over the place in many, many, many different countries. So. And then what then happened on October the 23rd and 24th was defused. I've had this from inside insiders also, and from journalists that were in Brussels near the NATO headquarters. And they said, because of that warning that I went out there, all the defense ministers of NATO was called to an emergency meeting in Brussels, in where they were, apparently they had like crisis meetings. We're talking inside jobs now. They were going to be blamed on terrorists. Nope, the real terrorists from the inside. That's what I'm saying. And so they decided that they had to stop the whole thing and then wait for this whole thing to blow over. Because within 24 hours, we made different calculations. It seems like maybe around a million people had become aware of this whole thing. And then that's the light on conspiracies, when you got the spotlight right on them, if they pull the trigger. You know, it's like standing in the middle of a football stadium of Barcelona with 90,000 spectators, and they're standing there and they're going to blow the bomb, and all of these eyes are on them. You can't pull it off. So this is the power we have. Anyway, so what I believe, and I put a lot of effort into trying to see what was being planned, was that you had the John Hopkins Hospital, you had the CDC with the virus, the CDC in Atlanta, Georgia, which is the Center for Disease Control. No, it's the Center for Disease Creation. That's where it comes from. That the CDC was created after the Second World War to get at the very same time as the CIA, and just a few years before NATO was created. And all of these things, NASA as well, all of them based on Operation Paperclip, with German scientists, Nazis taken out and then inserted into these different operations. Anyway, so the World Military Games is another part of this whole thing. It was also created at the same time. And this is the World Military Games is like the Olympics, but for people that have been blown to smithereens in wars, you know, no arm, no leg, no head, almost like that. And it's funded by the people creating the war. So it's almost like this massive sadistic joke that first they mess them up, and then they sort of make them into heroes, and they make fun. You got the Clinton Foundation and the Gates Foundation. All of these are backing these whole thing. But anyway, so what was happening was that at the October 23 and 24, which is also the day of the United Nations, they really like to take these dates and really hit emotionally. So on that very specific date, you had the World Military Games in Wuhan, China. Does that sound familiar? Wuhan, China. That is where we're being told that the virus, whatever that was, it escaped. It was in a fish, it was in a bat, it was coming here, it was coming there. It was from Wuhan. That's where the whole thing happened. And at that very same exact time, the World Military Games was taking place. And that at that point, there were more than 10,000 or 100,000, I can't remember, but military personnel from NATO countries were on location there in Wuhan, right where in the center of this whole thing. So the whole idea with what went under the name of Event 201, actually, if you look at the Event 201, which is exactly where they went through the whole setup of how this was being planned, how it was supposed to be carried out, how they were going to control governments, how they were going to go control the military, the media, all of these things. They say it was just a coincidence, had nothing to do with this. Bullshit on steroids again. And so when you look at their logo, it says Event 20. No, the O is a globe. It's Event 21. Completely hand in hand with Agenda 21. Anyway, so the idea was to get all of this military personnel there in Wuhan. Then when they were there on October the 23 and 24, activate these 39 coordinated attacks that were there to completely destroy London, Manchester. These are all cities where a lot of real big false flag operations had taken place before, NATO countries. Okay, so London, Manchester, Barcelona, Paris, Rotterdam, and north of Stockholm as well. So the idea was when all of the military was in Wuhan, suddenly, boom, 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 the whole Western world in flames. You also had like a big drill of a nuclear meltdown in Sweden. So so the plan, part of this was that this radioactive cloud would slowly float down over Europe, or at least we were being told about that this had happened. So in the meantime, when all of this chaos was erupting, martial law was going to plan to be called. Everybody was in lockdown for our security. Lockdown, by the way, it's not a health term, it's a prison term. And the idea was to lock people in for their security, martial law, control these areas, because complete chaos. And then what would you do with the personnel in Wuhan at the time? All of these soldiers would be called home to their home countries, right? That would be the logical way to do. That's also what happened. But when what happened at the same time that they would release the virus, and then within 24 hours, all of these soldiers would have gone home to their home countries, bringing the virus with them. So in 24 hours, they would have created at least what they could claim was a global disaster, because the virus would be everywhere at the very same time. And so this was the idea, this whole thing. And then while we were in lockdown, the virus would be used as an excuse to keep us locked in. They would shut down the internet and keep us so that we couldn't communicate with each other. Martial law. And then the only way we could be let out was to accept the vaccines. So the vaccines were a big part of the operation, but absolutely not the whole thing. But then instead, when this whole thing was exposed, I can tell you there were so many things that happened where I had no idea what we had sort of, it was like we rammed an iron rod into this deadly gearbox, and it just came to a complete stop. So what was being planned there went completely bunk like that. And the only thing they had left then was to wait until everything blew over, and then wait for a big diversion when people were not so focused on this whole thing anymore, like Christmas and New Year, and then activate the only thing they had still left, which was the virus. And when did the first cases of this COVID thing, people say now it was in September. It was not. It was exactly on the 31st of December, New Year's Eve, boom, that's when the whole thing started. And then it took like three up until the 20th of March, when suddenly, like a lame fart in the dawn, was floating in like that, and suddenly pandemic and lockdown, all of these things, like where they started with Italy, then Spain, Portugal, Greece, these countries that are always hit the first and the hardest. And that's exactly where I was. I was there in southern Spain with my family, and we just got to experience the smack in the face with a sledgehammer.
When you talk about the virus, though, are you talking about it as a metaphor or as a real thing?
I'm talking about, as far as I'm learning, because I'm on learning, I thought I knew what I was talking about when it came to bacteria and viruses. The way I see it now, what we're talking about is, virus or no virus, the only virus that they needed was fear. So the real virus is fear.
And that can make you sick, by the way.
The fear is the worst. But it's also the only thing they really have against us is fear. That's the only way they can control us. Without fear, and this is also why I focus so much on breaking the spell. Snap out of it and see what's going on. And many times it actually didn't even happen. It was a staged event. Yeah. So don't worry. Bring the power back. Calm down. I found Elvis. He's still around. Wonderful person. Very brave individual that had to arrange his own death because he did something very, very brave. Please go to my website, lightonconspiracies.com. And there's a very detailed webinar where you can follow that whole thing. A beautiful individual, somebody that should be celebrated and honored, and which is very unusual in the area where I normally move. So, but then we had the Beatles. And I mean, I am a big Beatles fan, and I love their music. I've been amazed. I'm a musician myself. I'm like, when you listen to some songs, like my guitarist, like you got like Blackbird. Oh my God. I mean, and that was made
while my guitar gently weeps.
Oh God, that is, yeah, that's George Harrison. That's actually his song. But you got Yesterday, you got, and also the whole coming from She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, like in 64.
To Sgt. Pepper's.
To Sgt. Pepper's, Lucy in the Sky of Diamonds, all of, in 5 years, in, I mean, it's hard to imagine a world. Well, maybe now with AI entering, you see that within just a few years, the whole world can just turn around. But like in 64, when the whole world was shocked by the haircut of the Beatles, shocked by that. And from there, the level of naivety to sex, drugs, and rock and roll, LSD, the flower power, this whole thing in 5 years, unbelievable. And who was one of the leading influences? The Beatles. The Beatles were very, very leading in that whole thing. And where Sgt. Pepper's, that album was like a massive big thing. So very important band. It's said to be one of the, if not the most important band ever. And they've been giving all of these awards and all of these things. But also it is a band where a lot of tragedy has been following very closely in their tracks. You have Brian Epstein, who died in 67, very odd way, their manager, where it's like, what he died from, as far as I know, is still a bit of a mystery. You have John Lennon in 1980, who's gunned down by a lone gunman, Mark Chapman. Absolutely not true. I tracked down the real assassin. His name was Jose Perdomo. He was a top assassin working for Operation 40, where George Bush Sr. was the paymaster. Which was also deeply involved in the JFK assassination. So what did a top, top, top assassin do killing John Lennon? I mean, if they're just a boy band, like what's going on here? Then George Harrison was almost stabbed to death with multiple stab wounds inside his own home. You know, after that, he managed to survive and then he died from cancer, which if you're in my world, cancer is one of the favorite tools of death from different agencies. It's a very easy way to take people out. Or it could be a natural cancer, whatever that is. I don't know how he died. So all of these things. And then one thing that has got to me also over the years, like they were so productive. I mean, they would delivering all of these songs, all of these albums, all of these in record speed. Like you have a album like Rubber Soul. It was produced and all of it was done like 70, I think about 70% faster than any other band ever. And they were like recording 11 songs in like 16 days, if I remember right, where it's like where they were writing the song, recording it, arranging it, doing all of it. It's like, and then you had the timing from when they went. Nowadays, we have all the dates when they, this is when they started writing. This song was written there and in this hotel room there. And they went into the studio here. And then you see the dates when the record was being delivered and it was printed. In those days, printing records was quite a time-consuming thing, you know. And also the record labels, for them to decide, oh, this is going to be a single, that's the A, B side, B side, all of these things, the in which order the songs. And this group just managed to go in and just smash it, you know, like on incredibly short time, actually impossible time when you look at just from a logistic point of view. So things that has been interesting for me. But anyway, I've for many years, I just thought, there's much more important things to do. And by the way, love the music. So why don't you just calm down and stop messing with things that is of no importance, my opinion. Then, over the years, from the 66 and onwards, these rumors started coming that Paul McCartney had died, that he died in a car crash, and that he was replaced. For years, I thought, come on, give me a break. This is like, this is waste of time, life, whatever, to even look into it. And then there was a couple of Italian, it was a married couple, two forensic experts, like pathologists, that were very much involved in crime crime scene investigations and stuff. Also, you know, reconstructing face of victims and stuff like that. So they were very used to what now is more or less known as facial recognition, you know, how to measure and all of these things. And so they were fed up, this couple, they loved the Beatles, they were fed up with all of these rumors. So they thought, let's just once and for all go in and stop this nonsense. And so they started looking into Paul, photos of Paul before 1966 and after 1966. And what they came up with was completely shocking for them, was that it didn't match up at all. The Paul, when you really start looking at Paul before 66 and Paul after 66, they don't really look alike. The facial structure, completely different. The guy after, let's call after the 66, let's call him Paul. Paul, like F Paul, fake Paul. Before 66, Paul had a very round face. He was left-handed, round face, like his eyes were sort of like a bit like this, dark brown eyes, and not that tall. If you look at the photos together with the rest of the band, they're the same. He and Ringo, more or less the same, like this. And then after, when you compare with Paul, his face is much thinner, like this. Around his eyes, they look very similar. The cheek and the bones, all of that very different. And then he's like half a head taller than Ringo suddenly, like 10, 12 centimeters taller. I mean, how is that even possible? And so the more I looked into that, I was like, whoa, this is bizarre. Why would they do such a thing? It doesn't make any sense. And how could they pull it off with girlfriends and other bands and people that knew Paul, if that is true? And this is where we're getting into the area of thousands, I would almost say thousands, at least hundreds of hidden clues in the albums, in the lyrics, in the album covers, in Beatles, where they seem to have been pointing, saying, Paul died. Paul died. All of these, I mean, I'm not going to go into it. I would suggest please go to my friend Mike Williams' website or podcast called Sage of Quay. Sage of Quay. Mark Devlin is another one, very skilled. We are also good friends of this whole thing. Plus, I also did a webinar just yesterday. So please go to my website, the debunking of the Beatles and exposing fake Paul McCartney, where I go into great detail so you can see for yourself and also hear the Beatles talk about these things. I love Freudian slips. You know, when you say things, you're not even aware of it, but your body just loves the truth. So these, what is called Freudian slip, it just bloops out of your mouth and boom, there you have it. So
what's an example of in their music?
In their music or what?
Yeah, of either Freudian slips or clues.
Okay, so let's the guy, the fall person, his name was William Shears Campbell. He was the night when Paul died. I need to do it like this. What seems to have happened was that the Beatles were working on the Sgt. Pepper's. They were just in the beginning of creating that album. And up until then, you had the Beatles songs were very, like, quite naive. I mean, the Sgt. Pepper was a milestone. It was a completely shift into a new musical world that the world had never seen before. But up until then,
It was way more complex. Oof.
I mean, it's like night and day. Mm. So what happened? Also, at the very same time, the Beatles decided that they were not going to be on stage anymore, that they were going to only focus on studio work and would not really be shown in public. They would not be seen in public. That happened, boom, at the very same time. So as far as I know, and this is where many researchers are saying the same thing, was that on either the 9th of November 1966, which is 9/11, or the 11th of September 1966, a very interesting date, since we have 9/11 2001, but anyway, the exact same numerology. The Beatles were working in the Abbey Road studio, and John and Paul got into an argument. It was 5 a.m. in the morning, and Paul just said, shit, I'm getting out. I can't take this anymore. So he left the studio. It was raining. He got into a sports car, a white sports car, and he took off. He was driving down the road, and apparently there was this young girl that was hitchhiking, and he stopped, picked her up, took off again. And what happened was that when the girl suddenly saw that that it was Paul McCartney, this was the time of Beatlemania where they just went completely crazy. She started like going like this and pulling him and all night, and he lost control of the car, skidded off the road. The car got smashed. He was went out. He was even decapitated. His head was cut off, and he was completely his body was absolute mess. When that happened, the band was called in. The ones that contacted the band, that came to the studio and said, listen, we need to take you to a place, was people from the MI6. Very odd when you think of it. What did military intelligence have to do with that? But anyway, he was called in. The guy that was in sort of in control of the whole the meeting and that, his name was Maxwell. I don't know his last name. I refer to Maxwell Silverhammer and these in lyrics and so on. But anyway, so they were brought in and they were shown the body of the dead Paul McCartney. And I mean, the band members was completely devastated and in complete shock. And during that night, they were going through different options, because one of the inofficial but official reasons that this whole thing happened was to avoid a mass suicide among teenage girls that were in love with Paul. So, but I would say also the Beatles were one of the biggest income sources for the British Crown. You know, at this time they were bringing in a lot of money that the Crown would very much like to keep going. For I would suggest that we're just scratching on the surface. This is something that is much bigger that I don't understand. I just understand certain levels, layers of it. So anyway, so at the very same time, by coincidence, there was this lookalike contest, Paul lookalike contest on a program called The Bandstand. And the guy, the runner-up, there was never declared a winner. But the finalist, his name was William Campbell, and he was looking a lot like Paul, a lot. And he was also known as the man with 1,000 voices, meaning that he could sound like anyone. So they brought this guy in and to meet the band and say, okay, listen, guys, one option is that you continue, at least for a little while, that we do not go out and tell the public what actually happened, but we until we know how to deal with this situation, this is what we do. Paul continues to be around in the shape of William Campbell here. Otherwise than that, business as usual, and then hopefully in the next few coming months, we will find a way out. So the band, completely shocked, agreed to it, but William Campbell said that, okay, he saw this possibility. He was an amazing musician, but right-handed. But he said, listen, if for me to accept this whole thing, I need to give up my whole life, my whole identity, my background, my friends, my family, everything like that. I, as a person, will stop to exist right now if I accept this. So what I want, and I insist on this, is to take over control of the music, that I would be in charge. No more love songs, no more. It's going to go in a whole new direction. In enters Sergeant Pepper and the whole new way of the music that we saw, like, whoa, what just happened? That was the shift. So the band accepted. I mean, John was completely not there and didn't really understand what he was saying yes to. And so overnight, that's when they stopped performing publicly. And then the whole arrangement started where they were trying to make Paul, or they had to make Paul, look as much as Paul as possible. So he started going through quite a few reconstructions of his face and stuff. This is also why where you start seeing him wearing a mustache to start with. You can see it's the swellings under his lips, under the mustache. But also when he starts wearing a beard and stuff like this, this is because at one point you can see like there's swellings and stuff like that going on, and they're like doing weird things. His teeth starts changing also, becoming closer and closer to Paul. But the one thing they could not change was the shape of the face or his height. So anyway, oh my God, this is a long story. I would suggest check out the webinar instead. But
yeah.
But the sad thing is that when you start looking into the music itself, how could this band go from like three chord songs, She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, to Blackbird, Yesterday, Sergeant Pepper? These are like very advanced. I mean, I'm a guitarist. I played my whole life. Blackbird, that is not an easy thing. And that was the bass player. And then Paul McCartney, he dreamt Yesterday. It just came to him in a dream. All of the arrangement, all of the chords, all of the lyrics, all of it like that. I mean, please. I want dreams like that.
Eleanor
Rigby is another one where, but also with pointers to the death of Paul. And so over these years, there was, especially it came from John, a lot of the things he felt extremely awful about lying to the fans, because suddenly they were in this massive big lie that would be exposed at one time or another. And then the fans would maybe go into a lynching mode instead of Beatlemania. So he, the way he thought was like, if we put out clues, you know, saying Paul is dead, Paul is dead, Paul is dead, please see Paul is dead, then the day we get exposed, if we get exposed, we can just say, listen, we tried to tell you, but we were locked in by the contract. We really tried to do our best. And so this is the reason why so many of these albums and covers are pumped with symbolism and backward messages and stuff. And then when people started becoming aware of this, there was a DJ in the US that exposed this whole thing with the back messages, you know, if you started playing it backwards and stuff like that, messages saying Paul is a dead man, or Paul is dead, or Eleanor Rigby, this whole funeral where it's actually Father McKenzie, where it was Father McCartney, they changed these things. And, you know, so many different things were going on. This guy from the MI5 got absolutely furious because he said, do not dare to do things like that. That's where the White Album comes in suddenly afterwards, where no clues whatsoever, because they were even beaten up apparently and scared, you know, very...
Let me jump in, sorry, but did you not at some point say in some of your work that they didn't write all their music and that a lot of it was created by Tavistock?
Yeah, exactly. Because it's like when you, from a logistic point of view, how did they go from three chord songs when, and in many different interviews, they say, we're no good musicians. They all said that, we're not good. And then suddenly they were able to do these things, amazing, amazing. And when you listen to them live, the thing that they're good at are the harmony singing, you know, John and Paul. That's really good. The other thing, not very impressive. So did they have...
Ringo. Oh, Ringo was pretty terrible as a drummer.
Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, God. So it's like...
I don't think in that first album, I don't think he did any drum rolls.
And then... You have like interviews with you got George Martin, their producer, who's an extraordinary musician, and interviews with him, and he said, I thought their music was crap. I thought it was absolutely awful.
Mm.
What? So why did a producer get them under his wings, you know, if the music was awful. He said, I didn't understand it at all. I thought it was really bad. And but we're being told, yeah, but it was the combination of these incredibly talented Fab Four and him that produced this whole thing. Then we have, like you said, dear Ringo, who sucked at playing drums. If you listen to him, he's not steady at all. It's like, boom, he can't keep a rhythm like this. Then you have Quincy Jones, which is more one of the most admired producers ever. And the Beatles, he was working with them. He said, worst musicians ever. That's his statement. The worst musicians ever. Even at Ringo's solo album, they had to replace Ringo as a drummer because he was so bad at it. This is from Quincy. He said they had to lure Ringo out. Are you not hungry, Ringo? There's a restaurant quite far from here, but really good food. So they got him out, and then they got a studio drummer in, nailed the rhythm section. Then when Ringo came back, Quincy said, okay, so this is, listen to this recording of you. And Ringo said, not bad at all. No, and it wasn't you either. So there's this black drummer called Bernie Purdy, who has also stepped forward, said that he played on at least 21 songs of the Beatles, that he was the drummer. 21. And then you start seeing that from a logistic point of view, also the timing, you cannot fit it in. You cannot. And so it seems like the songs cannot have been written by them, because many of them are very advanced from a music theory point of view. These are like somebody with classical music theory knowledge have composed this. And then you have artists like Donovan, who seems to have been part of the creation of some of these songs. And then I think there are four different musicians or songwriters that have been pointed out as the ones who actually wrote these songs, which I don't know, I cannot prove it. But these ones are connected to the Tavistock Institute. And the Tavistock Institute is very, very important to understand, because they have been for many decades working in the background, completely invisible, but with the task of twisting the mind of the public into whatever direction they want. Right now, they are major in doing the whole transgender trick of messing with the people's minds, normalizing absolute twisted ideas that used to belong in Monty Python shows are suddenly now supposed to be normal. And if you don't accept it, well, you're just going to be lynched. Tavistock Institute, that tweaking it in the background. And so it seemed like, if as far as I know, as far as I've been able to find out, that the Beatles was the first constructed boy band. They did not just happen to meet randomly. They were picked up and they were sent to Hamburg, where there's a part of the Tavistock Institute, and prepared for this whole thing. Not playing nightclubs. There was the first constructed boy band. We have all Backstreet Boys, all of these nowadays, like this factory line. Everybody said, yeah, that's the way it's done. Well, I would suggest it was done like that earlier on as well. And so, and with an agenda. The agenda was what we saw from She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, to Sgt. Pepper's, or the Lucy in the Sky, this whole opening up society, completely diverting the attention of the younger generation away from politics, away from the Vietnam War, away from all of these things. I mean, the 60s was chaos in many ways. Away from that, into sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Put them on acid, calm them down, pacify them, whatever. Get them out of the way for the military-industrial complex. And by the way, if you look at when the Beatles were released to the world, it was just a few months after the Kennedy assassination, when poof, Kennedy's head blown off, and then you started seeing people saying, but wait a second, what's going on? And then She Loves You, Yeah, and suddenly the whole thing got started. And now it turns out that this whole screaming thing, the first ones were paid. They were paid to scream, and then that slowly started this whole thing going. And then when they went and conquered the U.S., the the young girls there were paid to scream. And so they were shown on the TV in those days, very few channels, and pumped out as the new phenomena. And then it just started this whole snowball effect.
On that note, Ole Demogod, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you so much, Jerem. And I also want to thank you for creating a platform like this, because without these type of platforms, this information wouldn't get out there. So I really honor and thank you for that.
If you enjoyed this, please visit germwarfare.com.